Okay, well, I think I said yesterday I would give a little kind of wrap up to the section on industry custom before we moved on to the next section of the materials. And some of this we've already covered, but just so it's clear, industry custom is a persuasive source of authority. Again, to contrast it with the area that we're moving into next, which is a more sort of coercive or conclusive form of authority, industry custom is suggestive. So to the extent that either the plaintiff or the defendant can point to industry custom as a way of either establishing on the plaintiff's behalf, gee, all the rest of the people in this industry were doing a better job and the defendant really was doing a substandard job with respect to this particular safety aspect, that obviously is helpful to the plaintiff. And contrariwise, to the extent the defendant can say, gee, the people whose lives depend upon the safety of their enterprise, they're all content to do the very same thing the defendant did. Doesn't that tell you something about the standard of reasonable care? Again, that is suggestive or persuasive. But as Learned Hand made clear in the Hooper case, it wouldn't be the final word. The courts were free, according to Learned Hand, and subsequent judges agreed with him, to set a higher standard if, in fact, the industry had lagged behind what a reasonable person would do through sheer stupidity or through the unwillingness to adopt a more expensive but worthwhile safety measure. It lay within the power, the authority of the court to say what reasonable care was, even in the face of industry practice to the contrary. So that, sort of in a nutshell, is what to think about industry custom. As I said, that's different from the kind of treatment that at least some parties will be asking for with respect to a violation of a statute. They're not content to just sort of make it persuasive. They want it to be conclusive or dispositive. So to bring that forward, we've got Martin versus Herzog. Is it Mr. Sokolsky? Is that how you say it? Tell me about Martin versus Herzog. I'm not sure it was foggy. Oh, it was in the gloom, apparently. Whether gloom was simply darkness or fog is unclear. Okay, in any event, go ahead. Think killed the driver, yeah. Right. Right. Okay, so again, here's sort of the diagram of it. The defendant's traveling so fast, he's coming around the corner. He's both traveling too fast and also winds up across the center of the road in the plaintiff's lane, and inflicts these injuries on the plaintiff. So the case goes to trial, and what happens at trial? Yes. In what did the trial judge rule in favor of the plaintiff, or how did it happen that the plaintiff won? Yeah, it was a jury verdict for the plaintiff. And again, as we're kind of keeping track of how is the appeal shaping up, what's the burden of proof on the various parties, the plaintiff enjoys the presumption that so long as it was a question about which reasonable people could differ, we defer to the judgment of the jury. So what's the defendant's argument on appeal? Actually, he's not contesting the finding that he was negligent. He's got another argument as to why it was wrong to impose a judgment against him. Right? But what did the jury say about that? Well, they did not find that the plaintiff was negligent. They found that the plaintiff's failure to have lights was not negligent. So what's to complain about that? If the jury makes that finding, the jury makes that finding. Or am I missing something here? Why does the defendant think he's entitled to a different outcome? Okay, Mr. Edwards? But how does that come into play here? Okay, it forms the basis of arguing that the plaintiff was contributory negligent, but what mistake did the trial judge make, Mr. Brown? Okay, why don't we just pause right there? So it's in the jury instructions that the defendant said he got a bum deal. So the defendant said the only way the jury reached this conclusion was because they were improperly instructed. So now we've got to look at the jury instruction and figure out, first, what did the trial judge tell the jury, and what's wrong with that according to the defendant? So, I'm sorry, say your name again. Sikolsky? How did the trial judge instruct the jury? On this point of contributory negligence and the statute. He said to the jury, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, okay, and just that one word there, the plaintiff's intestate, and that's the technical part of the fact that he died without a will. The word there is testate, not. That is, having a will, not. So he's a guy who died without a will, so his widow, under the statutory principles that when you die without a will, you get, you know, it's the widow who gets it, so on. Okay, so she's in her claim, or in the... in deciding whether her husband, the driver, was negligent, you should consider the fact that he was in violation of the statute, but the judge makes it very clear, I'm not telling you that you must, by finding that, hold him to be negligent. What's wrong with that from the defendant's point of view? Why does the defendant say that's an erroneous instruction? How could he have done it better, Mr. Johnson? Well, but let's focus specifically on what it is. What's a correct instruction? If that's incorrect, what does a correct instruction look like? Yes, sir. What kind of proof? Not just prima facie, but in effect conclusive. In other words, the defendant says, rather than sort of say, hey, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, here's some evidence. You want it? Fine. If you don't, that's fine too. He wants the judge to grab the jury by the scruff of the neck, stick his finger in the jury's face, and say, are you listening, folks? A violation of the statute is negligence, not maybe, not what. It's negligence. You got that? If the trial judge fails to be that emphatic, if the trial judge sort of floats it up as a trial balloon for their consideration, like Rod Serling, you know, on the Twilight Zone, submitted for your consideration, none of that stuff. It's supposed to be this coercive, conclusive kind of thing. Okay, so that's what the defendant wants, whereas obviously the plaintiff wants the jury to have the freedom to take this as they will And the jury in this case decided they weren't particularly bothered by the fact that he didn't have lights. Now, just again, so we're clear about the impact of this, under the law in New York at the time this case was decided, what's the legal effect of a finding that the plaintiff is negligent? Yes, sir. Yeah, they're barred from recovery. So it's a peculiarly powerful point that the difference between finding them to be somewhat negligent and finding them not to be negligent at all is the difference between collecting everything and collecting nothing. The modern rule would reduce the importance of this question by leaving it to the jury to allocate as between the plaintiff and the defendant, say, well, yeah, the plaintiff should have had a light on, but gee, that's only 10% of the problem here. 90% of the problem was the defendant coming around the corner too fast and getting into the wrong lane. But in New York at this time, the jury didn't have that freedom. They were stuck with this all or nothing thing, and any negligence on the part of the plaintiff meant that the plaintiff got nothing. Okay. So, again, the defendant's argument is I'm entitled to this instruction, to the treatment of a statutory violation as though it's negligence, end of discussion. And the reason for that, Mr. Johnson, I sort of cut you off there, what's the reason for that? Why are we so inflexible about this? Why don't we trust the jury to make up their own mind? Why are we grabbing them so rudely by the scruff of the neck and pointing our finger in their face and telling them what to do? It's the law. I mean, Cardozo's perspective is the jury should be no more free to set that aside than the jury should be free to decide for themselves what the standard of care is, you know. Well, this is what reasonable care is, unless you think otherwise. And if you think the standard of reasonable care should be something different, well, go ahead and use that. Here's the measure of damages, but if you don't like that, use something else. Wait a minute, that would be total chaos. The law specifies what the rules are, and one of the rules is you've got to have a light on your buggy. And if you don't abide by that rule, you have to face the consequences. It's not for the jury, in effect, to overrule the statute or simply ignore it. Okay, so Cardozo reaches the conclusion that the failure to abide by the statute is more than just a suggestion of negligence. It's the real McCoy. It is, in itself, as a matter of law, negligence. But he's not done yet. There's something else he feels like he needs to talk about, even if we've decided without any equivocation that this is negligence as a matter of law. We're not quite done with this case. What else do we have to think about, Mr. Sokolsky? Yeah, now I'll actually quibble with one little word that you use, whether it was the cause of the accident. I would prefer to use the term whether it's a cause of the accident. I will obsess about this when we get to Chapter 2, but just so you're prepared for that, I make a big deal about the difference between the definite and the indefinite article. But the major point that you're making there is correct, which is Cardozo recognizes it's not enough, even in a case of contributory negligence. And I sort of apologize here for the fact that we're looking at this question transposed onto the plaintiff's side. And I'm really interested in having you use the same kind of analysis with respect to a claim against a defendant. Same principle would actually work. It's like transposing a musical score into a different key or something here. You got to kind of do the little transposition. But just as we would be worried with respect to a defendant, not only about the Chapter 1 issue, did the defendant breach a duty of care, we'd also have to worry about the Chapter 2 issue. Yeah, but did that negligence or other kind of breach of duty cause the plaintiff's damage? Similarly here, we're not only concerned about whether the lack of light was negligent, we may be convinced of that to a moral certainty, but did that lack of light cause the plaintiff's death, or the death of the plaintiff's husband, as the case may be? What does Cardozo think about that? Yeah, now ordinarily, who would be in the business of making that determination? Who would we ask to decide that question? Or in this, at the same time, who's going to decide, except for this legal doctrine of negligence per se, which forces us to make this finding, who would ordinarily decide whether they were negligent? In particular, the jury, right? So the jury's going to ordinarily make the determination about negligence. So similarly, we would expect, other things being equal, that the jury would have made the decision about proximate cause. And quite frankly, we don't know in this case whether the jury made a finding on that point. All we know is that the jury came back with a verdict for the plaintiff. It's possible that the jury thought they were negligent. Remember, the jury was allowed, you know, they were invited, if you feel like it, you can find the plaintiff negligent. But the jury may have said, despite that, we don't think it caused the accident. But we don't know that because the jury got a bad instruction, and for all we know, the jury never found them negligent in the first place. All we know is that, what's that? Well, see, the jury has two ways of finding for the plaintiff. Remember, if the jury finds that the defendant is negligent and they find that the plaintiff is also negligent, the plaintiff loses. But if they don't find that the plaintiff was negligent, they can find for the plaintiff. Alternatively, they could say, we think the plaintiff was negligent, but that negligence didn't cause the injury. That would also lead to a verdict for the plaintiff. We just don't know. But even though we would ordinarily expect Cardozo to say, you blew it on the negligence question, now let's send it back to the trial court to do this all over again, and have the jury decide the question about causation, Cardozo thinks he knows the answer to that question. He apparently says, as a matter of law, the lack of light in this case was the cause, or at least a cause, of the plaintiff's injury. What's the plaintiff's pitch on that point? There's a full moon out. Which may have been, I don't know what kind of light we were talking about on the buggy. Presumably, if it's a buggy, it's like a kerosene lamp. I don't know how fast this guy was driving or what degree of control he had. Maybe you'd get an accident reconstruction expert to talk about how far away you could see a kerosene lamp on a buggy, particularly when there's a full moon out. It's not obvious, I would think, that the lack of this kerosene lamp on the buggy was the difference between an accident and no accident? Obviously, the defendant gets to make that argument to the jury, but whether the jury has to buy it, as Cardozo thinks they do in this case, have to buy it, I'm not so sure. In any event, Cardozo being the boss here says, "Eh, we know that the lack of light caused the accident." So the moment Cardozo decides they're negligent as a matter of law, the plaintiff's done. Okay, now, whether he's right or wrong about that, we'll put to one side while we do this second of the pair of cases. As I've said before, as with Bennett and Hooper, you got this pair of cases, and you have to sort of figure out, what's the relationship between them? Are they consistent? Are they inconsistent? Is one right and the other wrong? Are they just distinguishable? What should we make of them? Similarly, here we've got Martin versus Herzog on the one hand and Tedler versus Ellman on the other, and we need to figure out what to think about them. So, Mr. Hall, can you tell us about Tedler? Okay, so the statute says when you're walking down a street, you're supposed to be walking in the direction or on the side of the street facing traffic. So according to the statute, they're supposed to be on this side of the road walking over here, instead of which they're on the side with the traffic. The defendant negligently leaves the roadway and strikes them. And the reason they were over here was what? Yeah, so you've got all this traffic coming down this way, and they figure it's more dangerous to be over here than it is to be over there, and so they're over there, and that's where they get hurt. Okay, if you're the defendant, what are you going to be... first of all, what happens at trial? Citing. And in addition to the statute, citing, what authority does the defendant rely on? What case would come to mind if you were the defendant? Yeah, you'd say this is Martin versus Herzog, exact same case, as the expression goes. It's on all fours, as though... I think the expression comes from like a map where you lay the map, one map over the other, and all four corners match up. It's a sort of perfect replica in all relevant respects. It's just like the previous case. Statutory violation. Jury is allowed to make up their own mind, but we know from Martin versus Herzog that the trial judge has to be more insistent about this, and the trial judge, instead of saying, well, consider this, the trial judge should have directed a verdict on negligence in the defendant's favor. What does this court say about it? Well, actually, before we get to what the court says, if you're the plaintiff's lawyer and the defendant can't stop talking about Martin versus Herzog, how would you respond to the argument that this case is just like Martin versus Herzog? But hasn't Martin versus Herzog confined the discretion of the jury and the trial judge and put them in this inflexible box where they have to find the plaintiff negligent? Do we have to say, well, we're not so sure about Martin versus Herzog. That was then, this is now. How do we get around Martin versus Herzog if we're the plaintiff here? Well, there's actually, at the very end of the opinion, and I'll talk more about that in a minute at the risk of confusing you, there is a way of understanding this case from the perspective of causation. You could distinguish them on the basis of causation, but I want to get to that a little bit later. There's another way you could get around this case addressing the negligence issue. Ms. Olmstead? Okay, but in terms of defanging Martin versus Herzog, or indeed turning Martin versus Herzog actually to your advantage, Mr. Viviano? But isn't that the causation issue? What exception? And I do want to get to the causation issue, but there's another way to skin this particular cat. Ms. Stomper? Okay, but there's actually very specific language in Martin versus Herzog that actually makes our case. Ms. McLaughlin? Not exactly. Let's go back to the language here on page 25. This is Saint Cardozo speaking here. The gospel according to Saint Cardozo, and we get here his language in that first full paragraph in the middle of the right hand column on 25. We think the unexcused omission of the statutory signals is more than sentence. So, what's the key word there? Unexcused. Even the hard-nosed, inflexible Cardozo recognizes that this doctrine only applies to cases where the violation is unexcused. So you waive that. If they want to beat the drum about Martin versus Herzog, the plaintiff can say, Cardozo was talking about this case. This is a case where there is an excuse. Now, several of you were articulating that excuse. Namely, that to follow the statute mindlessly would fulfill its letter, but not its spirit. We have to look to what is it that the legislature was hoping to accomplish by making this rule. They wanted people to travel on the side of the road that would promote safety. And it says, in effect, regardless of your convenience, get on the side of the road that's going to be safer for your travel. And most of the time, that's on the side of the road facing traffic. And it happens in this particular case, it's otherwise. Now, even that point, of course, is debatable. If you're the defendant and the plaintiff's trying to justify walking over on the side with traffic, what would you say is not so smart about that? Well, if you're so smart, why ain't you rich? If this was such a safe place to travel, why is one of you dead and the other one badly injured? But in particular, Ms. Hocker? Okay. And these particular individuals, one of them had no hearing and therefore was particularly in need of having visual contact as the way to tell that there's somebody coming at them. So you could say, or you could argue, who says you have to travel over here? Why couldn't you have found a different route altogether, a different street to travel on? Or wait a while until the traffic cleared? You didn't have to violate the statute. But as you debate this question, you say, yeah, you know, the defendant's got something to say on this point, the plaintiff's got something to say on this point. Who's going to decide whether the excuse applies or not? The jury. So it's like Brer Rabbit, you know, getting thrown back into the briar patch. Here's, you know, the plaintiff saying, you can do whatever you want to me just so long as I get the jury to be the final arbiter of whether or not I recover or not. I'm happy to have the jury decide whether my excuse is one that they accept or not. The thing I don't want, says the plaintiff, is that the judge makes this determination rather than the jury. Now, does the appellate court wind up finding this particular argument persuasive? That is, the plaintiff's argument that it was properly left to the jury? Yeah, they do. They let the plaintiff's verdict stand. Again, finding that this case is distinguishable from Martin versus Herzog in that no one was arguing in Martin versus Herzog that the lack of the light on the buggy was excused. Maybe if they thought about it, they could have said, well, gee, we used to have a light, but the light broke, or a tree fell on it, or, you know, it was an emergency and I had to get to town to get my wife, you know, some medical care. Some other reason why their failure to have a light was excused. No one made that pitch in Martin versus Herzog. Here, in effect, they did. So, again, the distinguishing feature is that where there's a plausible excuse offered by the plaintiff, or in if you flipped it around, a case brought against a defendant where the plaintiff's trying to use the statutory violation by the defendant to establish negligence as a matter of law, the person who's being accused of the statutory violation may keep it within the province of the jury if they can offer a plausible excuse. And the court thought this was a plausible excuse, that it wound up fulfilling the purpose of the statute, even though the plaintiffs wound up transgressing the letter of the statute. Now, I want to talk for just a moment about this causation issue, which is found at the bottom of page 28 and spilling over to page 29. The court says, in effect, there's another way you could allow the plaintiff to recover in this case, even assuming they were negligent in walking on the wrong side of the road. That negligence doesn't count against them unless it caused the injury. And unlike the previous case where it's a question of, you know, how badly did they need the light, it's clear that if they hadn't been on this side of the road, if they'd been on the other side of the road, they would not have been struck by this particular car. But the court says, in the law, we're interested not just in those sort of accidental causes, things which they call an attendant cause or a necessary condition. The court says, we're looking for things which can be characterized as an efficient cause, something that actually moves the action forward. So if I forget my books and I get out to the car to go run an errand, And I suddenly realize, oops, I forgot my books. I've got to go back to the classroom. And it takes me 5 minutes to get back to the classroom, find my stuff, pack it up, and return to where I was in the parking lot. If I then got in my car, got on I-90, and was then sideswiped by a cement truck, you could say that my forgetting my books caused that accident, because if I hadn't been 5 minutes later, if I'd gotten out to the parking lot when I thought I was going to be there, I would have been on the road at a different place at a different time. But we wouldn't refer to that as being an efficient cause. Forgetting your books doesn't make it more likely you're going to be hit by a cement truck on I-90. It's just a sort of chance situation. So what the court is saying here, and if this confuses you, just let it be. We'll come back to it in Chapter 2. But just so you understand how the court also sort of uses as an alternative holding here the idea of causation as an explanation, they're saying that the fact that they were on this side rather than that side of the road isn't the kind of efficient cause that the law expects as a basis for imposing liability. We blame people for accidents when their negligence helps in efficient in the sense of work doing, when it makes the accident more likely to occur. And in the court's view, they're saying maybe the jury found it didn't really cause the accident because it was a totally random chance relationship. I may have parked my car in the wrong place, but if it gets struck by a meteor, you wouldn't blame being struck by a meteor on the fact that I parked it in the wrong place. I just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Okay, so as I say, if that confuses you, let it be, and we'll come back to it. I want to just get started, if we can, on the next case, Nettleton versus Thompson, because it goes more to the viability or acceptability of the sorts of excuses that somebody, in particular a defendant, might offer to try to avoid a finding of negligence per se. Ms. Walker, can you tell us about Nettleton? Various what? Okay, yeah. Okay, which is a statutory requirement. Yeah. Who are the Thompsons? They're the defendants? Yeah. Okay, so the jury finds for the defendants, finds that they weren't negligent. And so what's the plaintiff's argument on appeal? Okay. And why isn't the defendant in this case allowed to offer an excuse, as we did in the previous case for the plaintiff who's accused of violating the statute, but we say the plaintiff gets to make their pitch about excusing it? What's wrong with that here? I'm just sort of asking, why isn't the defendant, or maybe I should let you finish the story here, the plaintiff argues that the trial judge was wrong to instruct the jury in this way. What does the Supreme Court of Idaho say? Okay, so the court winds up rejecting their excuse and rejecting the idea that the jury can even consider it. The Idaho Supreme Court says the trial judge should have done what Cardozo thinks trial judges should do, take the jury by the scruff of the neck and force them to make a finding of negligence. Now, first of all, In looking at the kinds of excuses, I actually, just before the case, there in the notes here on page 29, there's a little excerpt from the restatement in the right-hand column on excused violations. And these are the kinds of things that might be offered by way of excuse. And under what category would the defendant argue that they're situation fell? So it says, a violation is excused when, and then it lists A through E. Which of those looks like the best candidate for the defendant's argument of an excuse? Yeah. And again, the defendant's argument was, my goodness, I don't walk around with, you know, the uniform building code memorized, and I wasn't out there with my tape measure looking at how long these stairs were. It took me by surprise, and you can't say that I should have known of the contents of the building code. Why? And this is the point of the visit by the tax assessor. Even the tax assessor goes through my house, and the tax assessor never says, oh, gee, did you know you're in violation of the building code? Now, what's wrong with that argument from the Supreme Court's point of view? But isn't that a question of, isn't the question the reasonableness of their behavior still one to be left to the jury? Why is it we can't let the jury even consider this as a potential excuse? And that recitation is, in fact, part of our test as to whether or not negligence per se applies, as we'll talk about in the end, in the notes and so forth. In addition to showing that there's a statutory violation, you also have to show that the statute was intended to prevent this kind of harm. So in one of the cases in the notes, Goris versus Scott, this famous old case where the sheep gets swept overboard, the owner of the vessel is not found liable because the requirement that they all be in pens was directed to health considerations rather than avoiding the loss of animals from a storm. Well, they perform different functions. I mean, it does seem like we're sort of comparing apples to oranges there. It'd be one thing if you had, for example, the building inspector who came and looked at it, but uh, The trial judge does seem to be fairly lenient here in terms of allowing the defendant to make their pitch. But eventually the Supreme Court cures all of that because they say that the defendant's excuse falls into a particular category of excuses that we do not recognize. Even though the defendant's trying to shoehorn this into the, gee, I didn't know about the occasion for compliance, the Supreme Court says, but what this really falls within is the category of ignorance of the law. So the defendant is saying not so much, I didn't know that the railing was missing. That would be ignorance of the facts. Here, what they're arguing is, I didn't know the law required me to do this. And this is less of a problem in a civil context. It's more puzzling in a criminal context. And in your criminal law class, I expect you'll spend some time puzzling over the fact that when we're deciding whether to send somebody to jail, we don't take into account whether they knew about the law of the violation of which they're being prosecuted for. And there are times when, obviously, if someone said, gee, I didn't know it was against the law to steal, we'd say, well, tough luck, buddy. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. But if somebody's being prosecuted for carrying a firearm and they believe, and perhaps quite plausibly so, that there's some statutory exception that says peace officers are not, you know, you can't carry a firearm except if you're a peace officer, and somebody thinks because they're an off-duty corrections officer they fall within this exception, and turns out the court decides they don't, that the courts don't take into account whether your belief about the law was reasonable or not. And you actually, at least in way back when I taught criminal law, spent some time puzzling over, well, exactly what principle makes us so fussy about this particular principle, whereas the law does take into account ignorance of the facts. So if I pick up an umbrella on my way out of the classroom, mistaking the umbrella for my own when in fact it belongs to someone else, I'm not guilty of theft even if I negligently failed to check to see whose umbrella it was. Unless you can prove that I, in effect, knew it was my umbrella, I'm not guilty of theft. But there's no such requirement with respect to the law. There's no requirement that I know anything about the law or that I was acting unreasonably in thinking that my behavior was lawful. So eventually the court gets to the point where they say, look, in order to get this excuse to the jury, it has to be objectively reasonable. Not just any old excuse will do, the dog ate my homework. It's got to be one which we would say, oh, a reasonable, you know, a person is entitled to rely on that as a basis for failing to comply with the statute. And so these five items, it's excusable because of the actor's incapacity or because he neither knew or should have known about the occasion for compliance. He tried to comply, or there's an emergency, or compliance would be a greater risk than non-compliance. None of those fit ignorance of the law. As you pointed out, B is the closest one, but that's actually ignorance of the facts, as it turns out. So again, you'll pick up that in more detail when you talk about criminal law, but the court winds up rejecting that for purposes of making an excuse to a statutory violation. Tomorrow, we will start with the little review that's on page 32. Just in the questions and notes, what does happen or what is the procedure by which we make a finding that negligence per se applies and we're going to short-circuit the process of letting the jury decide a question? How is it that we make a finding of negligence per se and then the subsequent questions from that decision tree as well. So we'll see you tomorrow.